Well, it's par for the course in most temples. The mic stands don't work so well. But today we're studying a famous verse of Srimad Bhagavatam on the first canto, second chapter, text number 11. So it's up here, and we'll do the word meanings. Vedanti, they say, tat that, tatva vida, the learned souls, tatvam, the absolute truth, yat, which, jnanam, knowledge, advayam, non-dual, Brahma iti, known as Brahman, Paramatma iti, known as Paramatma, Bhagavan iti, known as Bhagavan, Sabyate, it's so sounded. Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajnanam advayam prameti paramatmeti bhagavan iti sadyate vedanti tat tatva vidas tvam yajnanam advayam prameti paramatmeti bhagavan iti sadyate vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajnanam advayam prameti paramatmeti Bhagavan iti sabjate. Translation. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. So can someone read the, you want to read the report?
The absolute truth is both subject and object, and there is no qualitative difference there. Therefore, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are qualitatively one and the same. The same substance is realized as impersonal Brahman by the students of the Upanishads, as localized Paramatma by the Hiranyagarbhas, or the yogis, and as Bhagavan by the devotees. In other words, Bhagavan, or the personality of Godhead, is the last word of the absolute truth. Paramatma is the partial representation of the personality of Godhead, and impersonal Brahman is the glowing effulgence of the personality of Godhead, as the sun rays are to the sun god. Less intelligent students of either of the above schools sometimes argue in favor of their own respective realization, but those who are perfect seers of the absolute truth know well that the above three features of the one absolute truth are different perspective views seen from different angles of vision.
As it is explained in the first shloka of the first chapter of the Bhagavatam, the Supreme Truth is self-sufficient, cognizant, and free from the illusion of relativity. In the relative world, the knower is different from the known. But in the absolute truth, both the knower and the known are one and the same thing. In the relative world, the knower is the living spirit or superior energy, whereas the known is inert matter or inferior energy. Therefore, there is a duality of inferior and superior energy, whereas in the absolute realm, both the knower and the known are of the same superior energy. There are three kinds of energies of the supreme energetic. There is no difference between the energy and the energetic, but there is a difference of quality of energies. The absolute realm and the living entities are of the same superior energy, but the material world is inferior energy. The living being in contact with the inferior energy is illusioned, thinking he belongs to the inferior energy. Therefore, there is the sense of relativity in the material world. In the absolute, there is no such sense of difference between the knower and the known, and therefore everything there is. And therefore, everything there is absolute.
Okay, thank you. So, as I mentioned, this is one of the key instructions, a very foundational verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So I can see why the creators of the curriculum wanted to focus on this one verse in a class, devote a whole class to it. So let's sort of see where it comes in the perspective of the discussion in Srimad Bhagavatam. This chapter, the second chapter of Bhagavatam, begins the reply of Suta Goswami to the sages that were gathered at Naimisharanya. And why were they gathered there, the sages at Naimisharanya? Can anyone say why they were gathered there? Just in general, purpose of their gathering, yes? Krishna? Yeah, for the welfare of society. I mean, the sages gathered there for the welfare of society, not for any other purpose. And so, therefore, to pursue that purpose of their meeting, they began to ask questions. And so the questions basically come down to one thing. What is the purpose of life? That's the basic question they're asking there. Because if we know the purpose of something, then we can understand. We have the problems that may be there or the joys that may be there. We can have some perspective on them. We understand, well, why? What's the lesson to be learned here? Or, there are so many philosophies there. They see the world of that suffering in many ways. The existentialists, I think, particularly a lot of French writers, Camus, Sartre, they see the world as absurd because they understand the suffering, but they don't know the purpose of the suffering. And therefore, they see it as an absurd world because there's just suffering with no purpose. But there is a purpose, and the sages are gathered to try to understand what that purpose is. And so therefore, they're asking different questions about what one should do with one's life. And so those questions begin to be answered by the previous verse. No, actually, there are many verses leading up to this to talk about what one should do with one's time, with one's occupation in life. And then the verse before this, text number 10, says, life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's works. So this idea of inquiring about the absolute truth is given as what should be the purpose of life. There are so many different things that can be done in life, and of all of them, the most important is trying to find out about the absolute truth. So what is the absolute truth? Actually, a couple of weeks ago, Shamala Kishori asked this question, what do you mean by the absolute truth? She was saying, she asked that question because I mentioned that term in class. And so, as often happens in our progress in Krishna consciousness, the same questions keep coming up over and over again. So if we don't get a chance to answer it one time, then it's going to come back again and we'll get a chance to answer it again. So I get a chance today to answer that question again. What do you mean by absolute truth? And so that's today's verse. It describes learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. So this verse gives us some hint about what is this absolute truth. And there are three things that are mentioned, or three characteristics that we can take from this verse. After all, if life's meant to search out the absolute truth, then we need some clues about what we're looking for. Right? Otherwise, we might miss it, even though it presents itself in front of us. So the first thing, aspect or quality or characteristic of the absolute truth is that it's non-dual. Non-dual, it's mentioned here in Advayam is the Sanskrit. And Prabhupada gives a nice explanation of that. His sentence is that there's no difference between the energy and the energetic. So non-dual has this non-qualitative difference, Prabhupada says. Some ways of trying to understand that are sort of broad conceptions, and I think that's the way we have to try to approach this. We're going to understand it, especially in the beginning stage. How are we going to understand what this non-dual substance means? Well, it means that it's kind of a unifying existence, isn't it? Duality starts to break things down. Seeing difference between this and that, between me and you, between a human being and the sunlight. We're seeing things that they're dividing, and there's some division. It's not a unifying existence. Even science, they search for this unifying principle. One of the main scientific principles was the unified field theory. Whose theory was that? Does anybody know? There's some. Okay, not one single person's theory, but just sort of a general area of study.
A unified theory.
A unified theory. Well, I mean, this desire is there, isn't there? There's desires there to see the unity. I mean, we see it in all fields. Socially, we want to see unity. Even now, moving toward unified economic markets or something like that. The European Union. So there's this idea of a unifying force. This is getting towards this idea of the non-dual nature of the absolute truth. One origin of everything, not a lot of different origins. Another term might be inclusiveness. Inclusiveness as this non-dual substance. Does that make sense to you as the first element we need to look for when we're searching out the absolute truth? Something that unifies rather than divides. Okay. Now, another characteristic of the absolute truth is that it endures. It doesn't change. It doesn't change over time. That it's enduring. Truth actually is like this. Krishna explains this in Bhagavad Gita. There's a verse in second chapter, text number 16. Krishna says that those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance. And of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. Thus they have concluded by studying the nature of both. I always found this verse quite interesting because I had the realization about it that if something is true, then it endures. It doesn't change. I mean, even in common language, you have the statement that the truth always comes out or something like that, you know, indicating that some principle or the real facts about something will endure longer than illusion or other things that are sort of built around it or built up to be falsity. Falsity has a limited ability to exert influence, whereas truth endures over time. It doesn't change. And so if we're looking for the absolute truth, we have to look for something like that. We can't look to something that is constantly changing. We need to find something that endures. Now, a third characteristic would be that if it's absolute, it includes everything within our experience. Okay? How can something be unifying, have one origin that doesn't change over time, if it doesn't include everything that we experience? For instance, if we try to conclude that the absolute truth is impersonal or devoid of personality, of relationships, of personal exchange between one being and another, how can the absolute truth, which is meant to unify everything, be impersonal if we experience those things ourselves, even in our conditioned state? Does that make sense to everybody? That the absolute truth has to include that too. It can't be something outside of that. There can't be something that cannot be related back to or understood through this unifying, enduring, let's call it substance or theory or idea or conception of life. So if we're talking about the absolute truth, it has to include all the varieties, a way to explain all the varieties that we have around us. Okay? Another way, using Sanskrit terms, to understand these three kind of characteristics of the absolute truth, what we're looking for, are the words sat, chit, ananda. Does anybody know what those terms mean? Sat, chit, ananda. What does sat mean? Yeah? Eternal aspect. Okay. And chit? The knowledge aspect, right. Knowledge aspect. And ananda? Blissful. Right, right. Now, so sat, chit, ananda, those are the Sanskrit terms that are used for people that are searching out the absolute truth. This is what they're looking for. They're looking for eternal existence, which is a cognizant existence, full of knowledge, not that existence is just a void or some kind of a dull kind of state. No, it's a full of knowledge, and it's a blissful experience. And so these are characteristics of what we should be looking for if we're going to search out the absolute truth. And why are we searching out the absolute truth? Why did those sages gather there at Naimisharandhya? Yeah, for our benefit. I mean, the sages, they're looking at us, and we can look at ourselves, and we can see that, well, you know, I got a lot of problems in my life. Right? You know, I was at the computer place the other day. I was talking about problems I have. My computer doesn't work. So there are a lot of problems we have in life. Some are big or some are small. But our true welfare, which is the real purpose of the sages and of spiritual life, is to help resolve those problems. And the sages are saying that you can resolve your problems by knowing the absolute truth. Okay. Is everybody convinced of that? I mean, I guess we have to be convinced of that to some degree, otherwise we wouldn't be on the path. Right? We wouldn't take up spiritual life. Or if we took it up for some other reasons, at least you should know that. This is why you should take it up, to try to rid oneself once and for all of the miseries of life. I mean, just think about that for a minute, how wonderful a life would be that if all your problems were solved, not just that they were solved, but that they would never come back again. I mean, wow, who wouldn't want that kind of existence in life? I mean, that kind of a satisfaction in life, that problems are solved and you go forward in time without them having to worry about them coming back again. So this is a purpose. This is the purpose of life. This is the purpose of the sages gathering, and this is the purpose of searching out the absolute truth, and we've given some idea about what we're looking for. Okay? Is everybody with us on that? Because we know what we're looking for, but now let's talk about how we're going to find it. How we're going to find the absolute truth. That's always not such an easy thing. But this purport, Prabhupada in the purport to this verse, he gives three ways in which we can try to find out the absolute truth. Anybody recall them from the reading the purport, what they might be, or one of them, or any of them? Therese, yes? Those are the things we're looking for. Those are aspects of the absolute truth, right? But how do we search for those things? Yeah. Okay, so Prahlad Maharaj, he uses a philosophy, neti neti, right? He's studying the nature. So through studying, that's also mentioned here in the purport. Prabhupada says, the same substance is realized as impersonal Brahman by the students of the Upanishads. So by study of the Vedas, that's one of the ways in which we can understand the absolute truth. And part of that is what Vaishnava says, is kind of a looking at everything around us and saying, well, that's not eternal, that's not full of knowledge, that's not full of bliss, that's not a unifying thing, it's changing over time, so therefore that can't be the absolute truth. So not that, then we look at something else, not that, not that, not that. And so by eliminating things through study, and using our intelligence, we can search out the absolute truth. That's one way, yeah. Yes? Inquiring from the bona fide spiritual master. Yeah, that's part of the third way. We'll come back to the second. But the third way of understanding absolute truth is to be a devotee. By practicing devotional service, one can understand the absolute truth, and a very essential part of that is, as Chaitanya tells us, to inquire from a bona fide spiritual master. That's confirmed by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, one of my favorite verses. I think I quoted it every class about just approach a spiritual master. How does that begin? Sounds? Tadviri pranipatena pariprasnina sevaya upadashanti te ganam gyaninas tattva darshana. So one who's seen the absolute truth, he can tell us, well, that's the absolute truth. You're looking all over here in 1880, this, not this, not this, not this, but I can tell you, there it is right there. That's the absolute truth. So that's certainly a way that Chaitanya gives. Any other ways? Yes. By yoga. Yes, by yoga. That's one of the ways mentioned here. Prabhupada says, Thursday at 7 o'clock, you can find the absolute truth. But what you find, we're going to talk about in a minute at yoga. So, yes, Prabhupada says here that localized paramatma by the Hiranyagarbhas or the yogis. So yoga is a way, actually that's the purpose of yoga. So many ideas about yoga are there today, and there are so many things that you can get from yoga that are good. Health benefits, you can calm the mind, get peace of mind, which a lot of people look for. So many benefits are there through yoga, but it's also a way to understand the absolute truth. And that's what it's really meant for. These other things are preliminary things. They calm the senses, they calm the mind, and they enable us to perceive this unifying, blissful, all-knowledge type of existence. It's not available through the chatter of the mind and the senses. The absolute truth is not available, so yoga helps us calm it. Yeah, so these are three primary ways in which we can look for the absolute truth. Through jnana, yes, go ahead. Okay, now, he just stole all my notes here. I know he must have been looking at it. Because that's exactly where we're going here. So thank you. I think it's a good when students are ahead of you, you know, in your outline. But that's where we're going, exactly. But let's get there step by step so that everybody's together on it, okay? Yeah, there are these three ways to understand the absolute truth. And they're known in Sanskrit as jnana. Jnana means philosophical study. Yoga, which is meditative way of understanding the absolute truth. And again, meditation is only possible if the mind and the senses are controlled. Then one can meditate. So jnana, yoga, and bhakti, or devotion. These three ways are ways in which we can understand the absolute truth. But, as was just pointed out, jnana, yoga, well, we forgot one thing that's often mentioned in these things, and that is karma. You know this term, karma. Why isn't karma recommended as a way for understanding the absolute truth? Can anybody say? Yes, Gopal. Yes. Karma is temporary. That's one of the things that's described in Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna in Bhagavad Gita eliminates that from our search for the absolute truth by explaining the nature of karma. And the nature of karma, that it's temporary. Actually, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's described that karma, or fruitive activities, is a symptom of ignorance. That's another thing that always sort of struck me as very interesting. If someone works thinking that I'll get a certain result, that's a symptom of ignorance. That's a whole other class, so we don't want to go there. That's just a side point. But since karma is mentioned with jnana and yoga, I just wanted to bring that up. So here's the problem in terms of understanding the absolute truth in terms of jnana. Or searching for knowledge, or using a philosophical approach, is that you don't get all three of the things we describe, which are characteristics of the absolute truth. Most people only get one. And which one do they get? The jnanis? Brahman. They get the impersonal and impersonal understanding of the absolute truth. Because, as Vaishnava was telling us, a big part of jnana, or using the study of the Vedas, using our intellectual capacities, a big part of that is not this, not this, not this, not that. So you basically eliminate everything that there is. And what are you left with? You're left with nothingness. You're left with the Brahman. The world is empty. And so by using our philosophical reasoning, that's the conclusion that we most often come to, that actually the only thing that really exists is a nothingness, is a void, an emptiness that... is somehow or another supposed to be blissful. But there's more to the absolute truth. Remember saying one of the characteristics of the absolute truth is that it's got to include everything that's in our experience, right? So how does voidness, a nothingness, include our personality, our relationships, our feelings of love? How does it include those things? Does it? Can it include those things? No, it can't. So jnana by itself cannot give us, cannot deliver the absolute truth. It's not possible. Jnana just cannot deliver the absolute truth. What about yoga? What about yoga? What do the yogis realize when they... Paramatma in the heart. Yes, the yogis, again, by controlling the mind and senses, they begin to see that actually I'm not alone. I'm not alone. I'm not doing everything myself. I have a helper. I have a well-wisher. I have a friend. And that friend is actually helping me to do everything from perceiving my surroundings to accomplishing whatever I do in life. This defeats the ignorance, actually, of karma when we see who's actually the doer, the Lord sitting next to us in the heart. So the yogis, they realize two aspects. They realize this impersonal aspect as the effulgence or the shining light that comes from the body of the Paramatma, that's a person sitting in our heart and helping us. But that also doesn't include everything within our experience. What doesn't the relationship with Paramatma include? Anybody say? Service. I hadn't thought about that. That's very good. Yes, service. It doesn't include me reciprocating with that person that's helping me do everything. It's just sort of like observing that person doing everything. And so it doesn't involve service. Yes, that's good. Anything else? Yes. Path. Activities. Yes, doesn't include the activities. So who is this person here? And what do they do when they're off duty, you know, serving me and making everything possible for me? Do they do anything else? So it doesn't include knowledge of that. Yeah. Our relationship with others. Oh, that's very good also. Yes. So it's just me and the super soul. What about everybody else? So it doesn't include that, how I relate to everybody else. So it can't be the absolute truth. That's good too. Yeah. Anything else anyone has to add? Yes, Gopal. Right, okay. The desire, my own desires can be there. Now I know how to really fulfill them. Before I was thinking I was doing it, but now I just have to ask him. You know, and he'll do it. So that's kind of a selfish exploitation of things, utilizing that knowledge, that experience for our own benefit. Oh, these are good. Anything else anyone has? Yeah. Okay, well, the yogis, they get two of the aspects of the absolute truth. But it doesn't include all these things that you all have pointed out. And so therefore, what can we conclude about Paramatma realization? It's incomplete. It's not the absolute truth. It can't be the absolute truth because it doesn't include all these things. It's not completely unifying. So now we come to Bhakti Yoga. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes. What is liberation for a yogi? Well, yogis often also seek to merge into the oneness of the absolute truth. I think that you'll find that even if you just go to different yoga groups or yogis teaching different forms of yoga, that they sort of have an impersonal philosophy. And particularly if you go not just from the manifestations here of different yoga centers where people practice yoga, but if you go back to their teachers from India, you'll see most of them are impersonalists. Most of them are impersonalists. So they go take that aspect of the absolute truth, which is a sort of a step back from the personal realization they had as Paramatma, but they don't develop that Paramatma realization. They regress back. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think that. I've read some descriptions like that. Yeah, the yogis, they merge into that Paramatma like that. Sure. Okay. Yeah. You're saying that he equates Bhagavan realization to these other types of realizations, and we're sort of sectarianly arguing for Bhagavan versus them. Well, I think what he actually means here to say is that people that have these two perspectives, jnanis and yogis, who understand the impersonal Brahman or the localized Paramatma, they argue that that's the absolute truth. A devotee doesn't argue that their understanding of the absolute truth is in conflict with the others, whereas they may argue that they're in conflict with the others. Impersonalism is in conflict with Bhagavan realization. Paramatma is in conflict with Paramatma realization. Paramatma realization is in conflict with Brahman realization and Bhagavan realization. But the bhakta, the devotee, they get all three aspects. And if you look at the processes that are executed, you begin to see this even from taking up the basic processes. The jnanis and the yogis, they have to give up stuff. They have to give up stuff, right? That's very much a part of their thing. But the bhaktas, what do? What do we say to people when they take to Krishna consciousness? Just add Krishna. You know, you don't have to subtract anything. Just add. And so right from the very beginning, we are unifying. We're tapping into this unifying absolute truth. Just add. Whereas the jnanis and yogis, they're saying, give it up, not this, not that. They're making you give up stuff. So we don't want to give up anything. We just want to add Krishna. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the perspective of the devotee. That's the perspective of the bhakta, is that it's not, when the bhakta sees the different features, he sees them completely. Yes, the bhakta does not deny there is the impersonal aspect of the absolute truth. He does not deny that the Paramatma aspect is there. But because he has Bhagavan realization, he understands how all of them are not different. Whereas the yogis and the jnanis, their perspectives do not include this unifying understanding of the absolute truth, and therefore they deny that is false, that is false. Bhagavan or activities or loving relationships, the impersonalists say, are what? They're products of illusion. That's what they say about them. Same with Paramatma realization. But the devotee, he sees differently. She sees differently. He sees a unifying aspect of all three features of the absolute truth. And that's the unique benefit of devotional service. Now, there's the example that Chaitanya gave about the sun and the sunshine. How there's one thing we're talking about, but we experience it in varieties or in different ways. Prabhupada also gives the example about seeing a mountain from a distance. From a distance, especially you're driving across the plains, you see the mountains in the distance. They look like clouds almost initially, but then as you get closer, you can see, oh no, this is a mountain. And then you get closer, then you can start to see that, well, actually, there's little towns and stuff on that mountain. There's like people there and everything. And then finally, when you enter into the mountain, you can develop into relationships with the people in the mountain. So he gives this as an understanding of how we can approach the absolute truth in completeness and how we see it at different stages along the journey. Yeah. Right, yeah. That's the completeness of the view of the devotee. And now, I have an example also like this, the one that Prabhupada gives, that that I'll give to you also. And it's about knowing a person. Now, ultimately, the person we want to know is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. But let's just take any person. There are different ways that we may know that person, right? Like, we may know of a person. We may recognize them. Oh, I know that person. I see them walking, past the Krishna house, going to campus every day. So that's a form of knowing that person, right? We know, we recognize that person. So we can say, yeah, I know that person. But that's a partial way of knowing that person, isn't it? I mean, we may get to know about that person. We might, what classes are you going to? What are you studying at UF? We know a little bit more about the person, right? We get more realization of them than just recognize them. We know a little bit about them. They're studying psychology. They're in their fourth year, and they're from Orlando. So we know something more about the person. But can we really be said to know that person? No, we don't really know the person. When we develop a personal relationship with that individual, we know their likes and their dislikes. We know their hopes and their dreams. We know their troubles. When we have a friendly relationship with them, we exchange with them in a loving way. And then we can really say we know that person. And so same thing with Krishna. Krishna, he reveals himself to us as we want to know him. Now, we can know of Krishna. Yes, I know Krishna. I know Krishna. Oh, okay. You know Krishna. We had one family member recently that was awakening into spiritual life. And they went to see some person speaking on Bhagavatam. It wasn't a devotee, some other person. And the person felt tremendously enlivened, and he knew us as devotees of Krishna for decades, but he didn't really know anything about what we were doing. But then he went to some talks, and now I know something. I know Krishna a little bit, but he wanted more. I want to go to Vrindavan. I want to see the Yamuna. Is that the same Yamuna that's described in the Bhagavatam, the same one there? I can go there? I can go to Govardhan Hill. So he wanted to. So there are different stages of knowing, different as we progress along the spiritual path, and we're meant to do that. That is what we're meant to do with our lives, because, as I said, that's the purpose of life. And why is it the purpose of life again? One last time. Why is knowing all this the purpose of life? Yeah, for the welfare, for your good. It's going to do you good to know these things. And if you know them, you'll be happier, healthier, wiser, more blissful. But that's just the beginning. These things are all just the beginning stages. There's so much more that's available to us in the process of Krishna consciousness. This is just like the second chapter of the whole book. There's 12 cantos and so many chapters, 15,000 verses. But right at the very beginning, the book tells us where we're going and what the purpose of life is. So any questions about any of these things? Anybody has? Yes?
Translations, obviously, they say he appreciates Indian philosophy, but the thing is, when it comes to parts of the individual soul, because what happens is that the individual particular nature of the soul is lost, and that whole idea of the whole idea of our individual self and the world around us becomes very insignificant and almost unnecessary. He says that, so he felt that the complete philosophy is actually available in Christianity because you talk about your individual soul, environment, and also the relationship with God. In one sense, he feels very challenging to be able to recognize that. But at the same time, because there's not a duty you were exposed to, I think the time that Mother Charis, Rita Kwasi, and Mother Charis, and Rita Kwasi, as they were growing up, they were in English, so we didn't have knowledge, so that's that said.
Yeah, well, I think I can say that Prabhupada said, at least that's the impression I get of recalling Prabhupada's reactions to Christianity over the course of the time when he was with us here, is that he termed it as almost like Krishna consciousness because this personal relationship with God is there. This understanding is so much key to Krishna consciousness that we have a personal, eternal relationship with God. And to the degree that Christianity or any other religion recognizes that, we accept and embrace that especially because there's so much impersonalism. There are many philosophers that are studied, Western philosophers, who ultimately conclude that individuality causes misery and therefore the absolute truth doesn't include a personal understanding. And so that's something we are not interested in. That's people that are only seeing one aspect of the absolute truth, but this eternal relationship with God is there, and that's more in line with the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes. That's true. Yeah, I mean, Sunyavad, yes, Buddhist. Yeah, you're right. That this gives us a broad way to look when we're searching for the absolute truth. We still have a lot of work to do. This is an initial orientation, and we can understand the world in these terms, and then proceed to find out more.